to Talking Walking, hosted by Andrew Stuck from Rethinking Cities in London. Talking Walking brings you interviews with people from the world of walking, artists, activists, professionals, and those of us who have a passion for just taking a walk. In this interview, recorded over a poor connection via the internet, we hear from Professor Jody Rosenblatt-Nadiri, Chair of the Landscape Architecture Department at Ball State University in Indiana in the USA. The interview begins with Jody talking about her research into street trees and their effect on driver and pedestrian behaviour. We discuss how cities can be judged on how civilised they are by the quality of the walking environment they offer, and ends with a discussion of Jody's research into the philosopher's walk. As it is difficult to make out some of Jody's comments in parts of the interview, we've provided a transcript which is available to download from the Talking Walking website.
How did you get involved in working and researching aspects of walking and the pedestrian environment?
Probably the first thing it would be that I love trees, and and I love being around nature and being with nature. And the work I was doing in Toronto was challenging whether or not it was appropriate to plant these trees in the city along streets. I was really keen on it. I wanted to plant trees everywhere. When I started looking into it, there was sort of a residual idea that cars would run off the road and they would crash into trees and people would die, and so trees were bad and so they shouldn't be planted. And this led me into some very in-depth research on the effect of trees on cars, and particularly on accidents and particularly on death. And my research was showing that every place where I was doing these major plantings and everything, and I was doing it because there were pedestrians around who wanted trees for, you know, microclimate attenuation or for aesthetics or a sense of identity and all that, the effect on the cars was quite the opposite. It was saving lives. Crashes were reducing and, you know, there was less body damage, there was less property damage. And so the sort of wives' tale about trees, I wound up disproving it. And in the process, I got really involved with the pedestrian realm along transportation corridors. You know, because the trees and what I was trying to do with urban forestry was a system that was running parallel and in some cases interwoven with the civic space of the pedestrian. That's what got me into pedestrians, was really the trees, you know. Trees that the pedestrians love is what brought me to the pedestrian.
I'm intrigued about the trees alongside the highways, that when you started looking at this and you actually found that they contributed to making both the driver's environment safer and that of the pedestrians. You know, was it certain types of trees? Was it distance apart of trees? Was it the age or the growth of the trees?
There have been a lot of studies done since that original bit of research, you know, 15 years ago or almost 20 years ago now. And I think some people are playing with the idea of the spacing, figuring that, you know, if you can manipulate the spacing, you can give people a different sense of their speed, make them think they're going faster than they're going, you know. If you can use a diversity of trees, you can get a more complex edge along the, you know, cone of vision. And the more complex the edge, the higher the sort of friction effect. And the closer they are to the curb, interestingly enough, the slower the drivers will go, which results in reducing the severity of the crashes. I'm making generalities here, and I have to say that it is a very site-specific thing. It's not just the tree sort of standing on its own, you know, in some kind of an abstract standard. It does matter where the road is, how wide it is, and all these kind of things as to what kind of treatment you'd put in on the side. And then for the pedestrians, it seemed that the presence of the trees certainly made a difference in their perception of whether or not the pedestrian realm was meant for them, or whether it was okay that they were there. If the sidewalks were built, for instance, we found out that building a sidewalk didn't mean that the pedestrians would want to use it, particularly parents of young children. You know, they wouldn't want their kids to use it unless it was set back away from the road And they felt a lot better about it if it also had trees in that lateral separation. So I guess if I were to say anything, it would be get the pedestrians as far away from the vehicular traffic as you can, which is sort of duh, a buffer of trees, it's better.
Physical presence of the trees then was felt by pedestrians as being a barrier so that cars, if they came off the roadway, they would collide with the trees and not with the children.
That was definitely part of it, and stated exactly as that I feel protected by the trees. They are preventing the cars from hitting me when I'm walking. I got that in some of the interviews. But the other thing that seemed to be happening, which is kind of interesting regarding the children, is it had to do with the way the children walk. They don't go down a straight line. They go all over the place. They're moving forward in a kind of trajectory, but there's a lot of lateral distance, particularly in groups of kids. And all of the mothers and fathers that we interviewed said that when their child is walking with their friends, they want at least 2 to 3 meters of lateral separation from the road. And when we would ask them why that seems so much, you know, in these narrow ways, they would say that it's because the children walk 3 abreast. And the one who is on the curbside, if they start pushing and moving around, that child will wind up stepping into the curb lane. So because children walk 3 abreast, if they're 4, they walk 2 and 2. But if they're 3, they will walk 3 abreast. They really felt that to make an environment safe for children, it needed to have a substantially wider separation from the cars than they would want for themselves or than they would think that the adults would need. That idea of the tree buffering you from being hit by the car was one thing. And the other thing was that it created this environment that was a little bit of spillover for the pedestrian activities that might spread beyond the width of the sidewalk.
What you'd said earlier on, which I think was very intriguing, was that the pedestrians began to feel that these places on the sides of roads, which were protected by the trees, were places for pedestrians to walk.
That they belong there.
Yes. Now, I think the other thing that I'm intrigued about, understanding about the width of the actual path, not the width of the buffer, but the width of the path for the pedestrian, did you find that people were attracted to wider paths or narrow paths, or did their pace speed up, or did children become more excitable in a wider space or a narrow space? And was that affected by the distance of the buffer as well? I'm trying to sort of find out whether there are connections between what makes an attractive place that we want to dawdle around and play in, and combine playing and walking to somewhere where we don't want to be for very long, and we speed up to walk out of it.
Yes, the answer is yes. There are places that are wonderful to be in and to play, and these are designed and physically exist in ways different than places where you're not allowed to play, or you're not supposed to play, or you don't feel like playing. You know, I mean, if you imagine the effect of the environment can be one that can either be inhibiting or nurturing. Just imagine yourself, where do you like to play? I mean, what kind of features are there? Maybe there's sunlight, or maybe there's a nice tree to climb, or places to hide and seek, you know, and this kind of thing. A place where you wouldn't want to play at all would just, you know, be very, very stark and very open, maybe buffeted by winds or noise, maybe strangers that you might not feel sure about. But designing a place where you feel like stopping, feel like pausing, and sort of going, wow, this is fun, this is great, nice to be here. These places are designed in a holistic kind of way. They're protected, they give you a beautiful view, maybe. It depends on a lot of different things that come together to make a real strong sense of place, you know, one where you feel like you belong. We're looking into more and more of how the variables come together that physically contribute to a place that makes you happy or makes you feel like playing or just feel like being there at all. There are some features, characteristics of these places that keep repeating. For instance, people really like to have views of infinity. You know, wow, look at that. They like that. They like being in places that give them an opportunity to look up and catch a view of something really far away. What would maybe make people want to go and play in a space like this? I think they have to feel like the space is designed with them and with playing in mind. If the dominant feature in the landscape are a whole bunch of interventions that deal with directing traffic through a space, curbs and stop signs and traffic lights and, you know, all kinds of infrastructure that clutters the public space with all kinds of signals for the driver, then clearly you're in a space that's meant for a driver. You can try to play in it, but it's designed for a driver. Whereas if you're in a place that doesn't have any of that, that has a smooth surface going from one side to the other maybe, that has shade and benches, maybe a place to get something refreshing to drink, then you're in a place that's for people to hang out in or to play in or to sit and watch other people playing. It's just a different kind of setting. So a lot of what we're doing, I think, in the research is trying to figure out what it is that people need to understand about the physical environment and how we would manipulate it so that we can create places where people feel welcome and feel joyful and feel like, you know, like they belong there as just a person walking on the earth, you know, just without a car.
Today I went on a walkabout in an area of London which is a pretty grim area in terms of environmental quality, and places to walk are very limited. And what was intriguing, I thought, there, and I had an interesting discussion with some people about it, was that there's more and more designing and planning of play spaces, spaces that young people can go to play, but there is less and less opportunity for children to play in their local streets. It's as though what we're doing is we're designing for children, you know, we're designing great looking and well designed play spaces, but they're sort of fenced in over there and they're not right close to home or right in front of the homes that people live. You know, we're going to divide up this space. Children can go over there, but they can't be running all over the place. Is that something that you've come across?
Yeah, I think it has to do with the notion of social space. First of all, understanding that the street is first and foremost a civic space, a place where community comes together in many ways, on many levels. You know, if children are a part of community, if we have a multi-generational community, then the equitable access to the civic space means that children and elderly, as well as the middle adult, all have equitable access to this civic space, to this network or system of open space, that the primary spine of which is the street. Even if you make a place along the street, along the way, that is specifically set aside for heightened activity by children or elderly or teenagers or whatever, you still have to get there. The path of getting there between nodes along a civic space structure, you know, along that spine, that path has to be an equitable one. And children, you know, the way they move through space, like elderly, is different. They don't walk like an adult, you know, who knows very well right where they're going. They can get to their car, they can get in it, and they can drive off, and they know precisely how to do that, and they just march along at a nice clip, and they get there. Children don't do that. Elderly don't do that. People, you know, who have movement disorders or psychological disorders don't do that. There are all kinds of people who are sharing the civic space. It's like our last, you know, strip of democracy. And if we start chambering it off and pretending like we've got some sort of no man's land that connects these various pods, then I think we're really, really undermining the sustainable dimension of cities. I mean, the street is where the life is. It's the conduit for, you know, all of our exchanges. So we have to acknowledge certainly that those who can't drive must be given, if not equitable, maybe priority pedestrian access through these corridors. This is just a change in prioritizing a corridor which already exists. You know, we already have a democratic network through the city. The corridor is there. How we treat it, how we design it, how we manipulate it, how we plant it, these are the choices that we have. But the space is already there. The big blank canvas, these network, is already there. I think the direction right now is to look at the street network kind of like you would look at your blood, you know, going through the body, or the bones going through the body. It's one of those systems that has a flow, that has a cycle of life going through it. This system holds within it access for the children, access for everybody, as well as the infrastructure of power, the infrastructure of water, the infrastructure of the urban forest. All of these systems are sort of braiding together through this conduit. And as we start to develop places, we have to be constantly aware of the interplay between these multiple networks that are flowing through the civic space. And I think if we can respectfully do that, then we've got an opportunity to really build something, you know, sustainable and viable with a very high quality of life.
Do you think we could measure civilization or the quality of a place based on how the pedestrian is treated? Something that we could go around badging more civilized places by saying they're more civilized because they have better facilities or a better environment for people to walk. And then we can sort of say this is a three-walk town or a two-walk town or any one-walk town.
Yeah, you know, when you say better facilities for the walking purposes, you could, you know, start rating cities by virtue of their walkability or by the quality of their walking environment. And I was saying that we can do that if we, one of the measures that we might want to use would be walking purposes. How many walking purposes are actually being accommodated? Like, for instance, we've got the commuter walker, who's the one that just wants to go from the door to the door of the car or to the tram or to whatever, and they're just going for it. You know, they don't care much about the environment around them, but they do need to be able to pass from the door to wherever they're headed, and as long as the way is clear, they're good, right? So that would get like a one star. They've got actually access, okay? And then another purpose for walking might be to walk for health. You want to go out for exercise. So you want to be able to walk quickly. You want to be able to, you know, get your aerobic thing up. So you need space that's, you know, relatively comfortable for that, that allows you to, you know, move quickly through it. Perhaps it goes in a loop and comes back to where you began and things like this. Then you have, you know, the children walk, and that's a very complex purpose. You know, children are trying to go to someone's house, but they don't necessarily want to just get there. They want to get to every little spot along the way as well. So the environment that we designed for them would be, you know, really wide. It would be filled with climbing things and tunneling things. It would be maybe, I don't know, in somebody's kitchen window and out the backyard and then across, you know, something else. And so the children's walking environment, their purpose is to explore on the way. And so that has to be accommodated. And then you have people who walk for relief of psychological stress, or, you know, they've just had a horrible day and they need to get out and just kind of decompress, just, you know, de-stress themselves with a you know, just a walk that will just let their mind just get totally relaxed. And that takes a while, and it does need some beauty, and it does need maybe a chair, and it needs a place to cry, and, you know, it needs some place to, you know, yell. So the environment for that, the design of a place for that, the design of a place for somebody who wants to go shopping and maybe meet with a friend and have a coffee and then come back, that kind of a environment might be another rating. So, I mean, if we took all of these different purposes and said, well, you know, cities that can truly provide walking environments for all these purposes that people have behind the reason why they walk, these are really, should be highly rated pinnacle cities, because they truly are giving a diversity of opportunity for access to all the different purposes of walking. You know, the one that I've been playing with recently has been this philosopher's walk, or people who walk for contemplation. The notion there is that people who walk for deep thinking or trying to connect with nature or a deeper joy, these people are the most demanding of the environment, because in our research it's showing that they are the most sensitive to the presence of nature. They're the most sensitive to the width and dimension of the paving surface that they're walking on. They will go out of their way to take a route that has certain aesthetic attributes and things like that. So, you know, giving people a chance in a city to start a 1 kilometer contemplative walk without interruption, You know, when they come to a street, the light is already green. The traffic will stop for them. They can carry on with their thinking or their conversation, you know, their deep, deep thinking. This kind of an opportunity to be able to step out of your door and take a 1 kilometer uninterrupted walk in a city, in my mind, it's a pinnacle walking experience in that sense that it is, if you can do that, I think you pretty much have got a city that can probably do all the rest of it too. Because it's just so hard to find that slowed down, deep thought, quiet time, and walking will give that to you.
So you found a city that offers that. Can you tell us a little bit about where you've been and the Philosopher's Walk in particular that you've been studying?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of them. The one that is the most famous is probably the Philosopher's Walk in Kyoto. It was actually a path that Nishida Kitaro, the Japanese philosopher, took for his daily walk to think things through. It's a route that follows along a canal and goes to some very beautiful places in the city of Kyoto. Also goes through shopping districts and more secular type places. And it connects up, and this is the walk that he took every day. And people got to notice that he would go on this deeply thoughtful walk every day and develop, you know, his ideas.
What time in history was this?
I'm trying to remember what the exact year was. He was a contemporary of Heidegger, so it would have put him in the early 20th century. His philosophy, I mean, the ideas that he's developed, I'm certainly not any kind of an official on what Kitaro's ideas were, very, very sophisticated, but some of the notions of being connected with some deep sense of time and place were some of the things he was exploring in his communications with Heidegger in particular. And then Heidegger and his students developed phenomenology idea. So I think what these philosophers were doing in their interrelationship with themselves and the place that they were in and these walks that they took is they were actually using the walking as a device to help think through ideas. And the environments where they did this are particularly interesting to me. You know, if, for instance, right now I'm in Germany and about to go to Friedberg, where Heidegger worked and studied, to compare the places where he walked with the philosopher's walk in Kyoto to determine whether there were any similarities. I just got off of a walk on the pilgrimage trail, the Jacob's Trail through southern Germany, the one that goes to Santiago de Compostela in Spain, to look and see whether that trail and the environment around it has any particular attributes that might be similar or different from the environments where other people who are walking for deep reflection. Is there something common? The one thing that I am finding that seems to be common in all of them is this idea of a constant rhythmic presence of, in many cases, water along the edge of the path, or that the path itself has a kind of rhythm to it. You know, the pace that you can get into begins to establish its own rhythm. There's a wall along the side that has columns that come at repeated intervals in a very steady kind of way, almost so that you could pace your body's pace and the environment's pace and come up with some kind of a synergistic harmonic between you and the earth, and that this somehow keeps recurring. The next step would have to be to start looking at the physiology of a contemplative person, you know, when they're walking. I find it fascinating that there are these environments in the cities and countrysides where people will go to think things through. Rousseau did the same thing. Kierkegaard did the same thing. So what is it about walking and thinking something through and, you know, getting in touch with a deeper part of yourself? How important is that to people and cities in struggling to survive in this chaotic world we have?
You had Guy Debord, the French situationalist. You have the idea of the drift or the derive, the wander, aimless or apparently aimless through the city. And here you're talking about someone who undertook a repetitive walk, followed the same route. Did he always...
Yeah, it was a very deliberate route. I wanted to ask you something about this idea of drifting. Here's my thought. I thought that maybe the first time Kitaro did his walk or Rousseau did his, or Kierkegaard did his, or Heidegger did his. The first time they did it, they just kind of blasted out of the house or hut or, you know, home or whatever it was, and just went out on a walk to work things out, almost the way anybody would. You're in the middle of something, you just need a break, you know, you get up, you go out, and you just walk. And then, you know, you start to notice things. You come out of yourself a little bit. You get see the way a sun will, you know, hit off of the dome of a cathedral, or something will happen and it'll bring you to attention. It'll bring you to a sense of like being. And then you go, oh my God, I'm being. I'm just being. And this clears your head, and then you can sort of chomp away at whatever it was that you were working through. Now, if that happens to you a couple times, I think you're going to get very intrigued with this idea of walking, you know, walking to work it out, walking to think it through, walking to get to that idea that's just eluding you, you know. And soon, the walking path, I think, that Kitaro starts to take every day, it becomes actually the way that he studies. It's like, you know, some people, they get their work, they get their coffee and their computer and their papers and their books, and they set everything up and they've got their time set and they go to work, right? Well, I think this is what Kitaro would do, except he would put his shoes on, take his cloak, get his cane, step out the door and go on his walk. And that's when he started working. And I think that this notion that walking is an intellectual device, you know, is something that's really, really missing in contemporary cities. And where do we go out to just walk about and get back in touch with ourselves and some idea of what we are and just being, you know? So this is good stuff. If he winds up finding a path that really works for him and he keeps going there, in a lot of ways, that's like the guy that keeps going, you know, he's got his coffee cup and his computer, and he knows the environment that he can work in, so he just recreates that every day and then work. And in a way, I think that might have been what Kitaro had done.
Other artists that I've interviewed about walking in art, quite a few of them talk about the value of doing repetitive walking, where they mm-hmm. follow the same route, maybe every day for a period. One artist in particular comes to mind immediately, which is Hamish Fulton, who mm-hmm. believes that the walk is his art. What he talks about is that when he gets people together, is that he will take them on a walk every day, and it'll be the same walk. Because what he says is that your mind becomes released. He says the first time you make that walk, picking up all sorts of things about it, the second time you make it, you're then beginning to recognize places. The third time, you can switch off about recognizing places and just see the out of the ordinary. And it's that sort of progression. And he says that you get to a point almost where the walk, as I think you're sort of saying about the philosopher's walk, it almost becomes a process that releases, you let go of things as you go on the walk, and the walk is reinforcing the process of, call it meditation, or certainly he's not the only artist who's talked about the value of repetitive walking.
There is this theory about arousal, which says that we place our attention on things outside of us that have a certain degree of complexity and interest, and that things which become less complex after repeated, you begin to know them more and more, so they become more and more familiar. And, you know, there's less surprise and uncertainty in them. I think I would quite agree that I think at that point, it's not that things become boring. It's just that you don't have to worry about it anymore. And there's a sense of security and comfort, so that you feel like you can let things go, because you don't need to be aware and alert to the externalities to assure your survival and all this kind of thing. You're pretty secure in them, so you can let it go, which would mean that environments which are simple, repetitive, would be more conducive to the deeper introspective thinking that a philosopher or an artist, you know, or someone who's really trying to get to some deep place might go to. And then in the middle of all that security and simplicity of the environment, you do have this expression of nature that happens. I don't know what that's about. You know, when I work with my students on this and I tell them, I want you to, you know, you're going to relax and just do go someplace familiar. And every time you get this, oh, aha, you know, moment where you just go, wow, this is, you know, I want you to record what that is, what happened at that moment. And so many of them will say that this is when they got their aha moment, when the sun did something or a little breeze came through or there was a shift in the way the roses were arranged in a vase that they always saw. And so they actually connect with nature, simple setting, and then this little zap of nature will just come through. Deeply profound connection. So if in the simple design of our environment, in the repetitive kind of boring, really nothing that we do, you know, as designers today, we're much more complicated than I'm talking about. But if we, you know, if we just did a little edge that just kept going along the side of a canal and it just kept going and going and going and going, maybe we need a little bit of that in order to get to a deeper, more profound, you know, connection with ourselves and who we are and where we are, that kind of thing.
So usually to wrap up the interviews, what I ask people is, I ask them to recommend a walk they enjoy taking. But I'm also intrigued too, I'd like to ask you, A, do you walk to clear your mind when you've got a problem that you're thinking on? And B, how far do you need to walk to achieve that for yourself, that aha moment?
Yeah, yes, yes. I do walk like that. I teach like that. I don't teach in a classroom very much anymore. All my classes are taught in motion, you know, while walking. By the 11-minute mark, I think I've gone fairly deep, and I'm testing now to see whether that's consistent. At about 11 minutes, you know, by then I've been able to make connection with nature several times, sometimes long, continuous connection of a, you know, just a sort of sub-deep level. Sometimes, depending on where I am, it can also be a series of in and out. As I get into about 20 minutes, there seems to be this, you know, I get back into the social world again, thinking about this and that, things I'm supposed to be doing and whatever. But the other day I went on a walk. I did that Jacob's walk. I walked about 20 kilometers, and after the fourth hour of walking in these back beautiful German villages, deep woods, gorgeous countryside, you know, rolling hills, and I mean, it was just fantastic with my students. I started to realize that there's something about the really long walk, the pilgrimage walk, which is the trail I was on, of course, but the long, long walk where you go for hours. It must be like the long distance runners. Eventually you hit this kind of point where once you break through that, you're just in another zone from there on out. I think it would be nice if everyone could get a chance to just transport themselves a little bit from the pressures of their life and just slow down on a walk, really long walk. But I was surprised that that really long walk took me into a totally different place than I had been before.
Can you recommend a walk, apart from the one you've just mentioned, the Jacob's Walk? Do you have one nearer home?
A walk through your own neighborhood, I think, tells you a lot. And the trick is, for me, is that the walk that I take has got to be immediately accessible to me. I love going on Jacob's Walk, but I can't always get to southern Germany. I need a place that's right near me that I can start walking and just, you know, keep walking and have it accessible to me every day, because I do like to do the same pattern for all the purposes we've talked about.
You've been listening to Talking Walking, brought to you by Rethinking Cities in London. In this episode, you've heard from Jody Rosenblatt Nadiri. If you have any views on this interview or any walking issues, we would love to hear from you. Just follow the links on the talkingwalking.net website. We look forward to having you along for future episodes of Talking Walking. Written, recorded. recorded and produced by Andrew Stuck of Rethinking Cities Limited. Our artwork is designed by Ian Martin of Aardvark Graphics, and the music is composed by Simon Sanders of Easytronic.